Welcome to our podcast.
If you enjoy this segment, we encourage you to check out the others. Also, if you're new to Hedgeye, you qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com.
Hi, I'm Keith McCullough, and welcome back to another Real Conversations. We've teed this one up. A lot of you have been asking for him to come back, and he was kind enough to give us some of his time. Thanks, Mike Taylor, for making the time. You're now some kind of a rock star on the Hedgeye content platform.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. I got my guitar right here, so let's get to work.
You look good, man. And it's good to have you back. Not often, as you know, do you get a live mic on somebody and say, hey, how do you think this plays out? And they give a cogent play-by-play on how something like this, which, by the way, you had no reps on, there was no experience away from your 20 years of running a hedge fund, of course, but there was no experience with this virus in particular and what was going on in the market. But you said quite clearly, look, I'm getting long, and by the time we reopen this thing, the reopening of risk effectively comes back. You absolutely nailed that. So I think that maybe if we start there, and you said this morning or the other day, you got your hard hat back on, like, how do you see the next part of this playing out?
Well, there's three stages: dismiss, deny, and vomit. And it works like that every time. Virus was not to come back per the CDC and the White House, and by November or some date after the election. And here we are, 4 to 6 weeks post-lockdown, and it's popping up everywhere in every state. In fact, I think there's only one or two states left that are still in decline, and the rest are growing. And one of the great sources for this is a New York Times website. They do a great job in modeling out each state. And it actually, I've modeled out all the major states to determine on how it's going to play here. But it is dismiss, deny, vomit, and we're halfway into deny. And dismiss is, it's not coming back, it won't come back, we'll be able to control it when it comes back, and we're past that now. Now we're into deny, well, it won't really do anything, because look, the hospitalizations and the deaths are low. And that will change in about 7 to 10 days.
Well, that's pretty near term.
That way. I hope that is not the case. But once you get sick, you're sick for 2 weeks, you're admitted. Frequently, you will pass. If you pass, you'll pass in the hospital 3 to 4 weeks post. And so we're getting to that moment now where those events should happen. And I don't understand entirely why it would be tremendously different this time versus last. There are a couple tools that they can use now, dexamethasone, antiviral drug by Gilead, and maybe a little bit more care in how they prone the patient's stomach down to help with flow, things like that. And they know how to identify patients that are going to be bad quickly. So I think the care is going to be better, but I think the outcomes won't be terribly different. I think that right now they'll probably take about 20-25% of the deaths off the table. But I believe that it's very likely we will see 100,000 new cases a day within the next 4 weeks. And that's really a count of New York, New Jersey, Maryland, Michigan, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania turning around in their cases. They haven't started growing yet because they were all late to get off the lockdown. And so now as we're approaching week 3, week 4, that's when we'll start to see the cases start to ramp. And that's how we get from about 45,000 cases a day now to close to 100,000. And if the other states don't control this, Texas, Florida, Georgia, and on, we'll be over 100,000 cases a day. And that will be at the end of August, into August. And that's when the governors will hit the oh shit button and start making changes about what school is going to look like next year, shutdowns, lockdowns, you name it. It's going to be a potpourri of whatever. And it should be, because the CDC has basically demonstrated that they are following a political model rather than a transmission model like mine. By the way, they have the exact same model that I do. Mm.
Well, Well, the rate of change model, I mean, it'd be hard. I mean, again, we don't have to know what the virus was going to be or didn't have to know when, what particular point that it was going to hit. But we do have to measure and map it from a rate of change perspective. This is basically what you said to begin with. You're going to have the rate of change slow, and then it's going to come back. So, again, is that just the point you have to actually be a dispassionate, almost from a human being perspective, and say, hey, look, I'm not focusing on deaths. I'm focusing on rate of change of case growth.
Well, in this regard, the model's a lot like your models that you have there, in that you are dispassionate. You simply have inputs, and you're extremely stringent in applying those inputs, and that's it. And what's rational, what's irrational? And to think completely irrationally would be to assume that transmission would not pick up. And what I think they probably missed, if they missed something, was the underlying seed population. And that's what we talked about a lot in the last call, is that when this virus comes down and there are going to be a third, 30% of the patients have a mild cold. And those are the ones that are spreading it and don't know they have it. They don't want to go to the doctor because, heck, I don't have it. I'm not that bad. I will catch it if I go to the doctor. And so they're spreading around. And I assumed at the time that that underlying number was about 150,000 patients in the U.S. And I was wrong. It's actually more than that, because this is tracking about 7 to 10 days ahead of my model. So what that means likely is that the seed population was larger than I thought.
That's interesting, because, I mean, Darius and I often say this to each other, and when we're discussing the rate of change of joblessness in the country, it keeps surprising us to the upside. And, you know, obviously we had a pretty bearish outlook to begin with. So those kinds of things together, I put them all at the same time, squarely going back into a recession after a depression. That's not a positive thing. I wonder, though, what you said on the political nature of it all. I mean, how do you handicap that? Obviously, we can see what's happening in the polls. Some people say, Mike, hey, look, I don't believe the polls. What do you think about that and the risks associated with the intense nature of the political arena going into the election?
Well, I think it's pretty clear now that, and I'm apolitical, honestly. I'm probably more libertarian than anything else. You know, hey, get off of my lawn. So that's me. But I think that Trump has demonstrated that he will do and say absolutely anything to stay in the White House, and truly to any level. And that goes from a fraudulent China deal to strong-arming the CDC into putting out fake projections. And it just goes on and on and on, is that he will simply do anything to get reelected. And the key in his mind to get reelected is going to be jobs and a stock market that's up. And can't accomplish it with jobs, he'll do it with helicopter money. And so we should expect more of that September, October, November, if the Democrats will play ball. And that's another topic that we should go into at some point in this call.
Yeah, what I always say to people, to get your helicopter money or to get your Fed that you can't fight, you have to get run over to begin with. I mean, so incrementally, it's a lot harder to do more from the all-time high in the NASDAQ. So it's the particular point that you need more cowbell that matters, and we will get into that. I want to go to the China piece, though, first, because you mentioned it. You didn't mention it in passing, but fake China deal, like, where are we at on this? You affectionately call the virus itself CCP-19. Like, can you maybe just give us kind of a nice Tiffany box with the bow on it, what you think about the whole Chinese situation altogether?
Absolutely. And I should have said this on the last call with you. The answer is there, where this came from and how it was developed. And it is sitting in the lab notebooks of the scientists from Wuhan. There are going to be 5 years of handwritten lab notebooks and minutes from meetings. It's all handwritten, and it can all be, you can't fake it, because it's impossible to fake 5 years of handwritten lab notebooks. Just impossible, because of, you know, hundreds of projects that were deliberated upon, corresponded upon, emails around, and failed experiments throughout that, and then meetings, minutes, notes from those. And then on top of that, the consumables. And consumables are all the things that they ordered from Thermo Fisher and other vendors out there that they used to to consume cell culture media, plates, all that sort of stuff. And it would all line up. And those are third-party vendors, so that data can't be faked. And you'd line it up, experiment, consumable, and all of it would be in the lab notebooks. We have no lab notebooks. All of it's disappeared. And I think that circumstantially that is a gigantic red flag. But there's a lot more going on, I think, behind the scenes. Not to get to the bottom of this, I believe that the U.S. White House knows what the bottom is. I just think that this White House is completely compromised.
So, you know, ordinarily, I mean, you'd say it's a layup for Trump. I mean, I think it's probably one of the very few topics where it's bipartisan support to be anti-China. You know, now you got the Chinese manipulating their stock market. We could talk about the PPT's impact in the U.S. equity market. And Trump's impact, obviously, and his self-interest in that. But how do you square that? Do you think that he runs into a political debate problem with Biden if he sides in any way, shape, or form with the Chinese?
Well, I don't even think he has to go that far. I think Trump is going to win the election. Even though, you know, look, I am dispassionate about Trump or Biden, but the probability that Joe Biden. Look, let's put it this way. In the debates, and this will be probably the first time we really see Joe Biden, in the event that he can tell us what day it is, he will win that debate. I'm not sure he can do that. And that's it.
Yeah, that's pretty straightforward.
I think that Trump is going to absolutely eviscerate this poor guy in the debates. And we may, and I hope that's not the case. I'd really love to see an actual debate on topics and so forth. But you've seen his commercials on YouTube. I'm sure you have, where he's stumbling all over his words in the commercial, and that's the best take. What about the 52 other takes? I mean, right? So that's the end of that. I am very worried about his cognitive skills. And I'm only saying that as an observer. I don't know the truth. I hope that he is well. I hope that he's very well. I hope that this is just some crappy YouTube commercials and they took the worst take possible and made that go to the public. And but other than that, I do question his mental capacity to perform in any way. And we'll see that at the debates. And I hope it is a great debate, but I do fear that Trump is going to mop him up all over the floor, but more in a sad way, not because Trump is fantastic, but because Biden is completely mentally compromised and he cannot be a candidate. And for that reason, the Democrats who hate Trump will go out to vote that they hate Trump. But the other Democrats that are going to be difficult, they're going to have a difficult time voting for somebody with mental issues like that. So they're just not going to vote. And then Trump wins. And I don't really mind either way who wins. You know, we can trade that. That's not the point. It's just this is what I think is going to happen. And there are many bets to go accordingly with that, mostly obvious ones.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, if you're right, if I'm right, I mean, if we get your version of the virus already coming back. I mean, you gave us a roadmap of 2 to 4 weeks, for God's sakes. That's no time at this point in the market. But if we set that up and we have phase two of the stock market crash, I mean, Trump's going to be able to scare the living daylights out of most Americans on the fly on that. He's already got his talking points. I've never heard a president threaten you with your 401k, but obviously that's on the table as well. And the more scared you get about your livelihood and your savings, then that might work. Anyway, that's a little bit off the rail. But just to kind of tie this back in and back to the Fed and back to the market and back to the PPT in general. One, do you believe in the PPT? Some people say, well, what the hell is the PPT? And why do you keep talking about PPT at 2 to 3 in the morning?
Oh my God. Do you mean the payment protection program? I'm sorry, did you say PPP or?
The PPT, the plunge protection team.
Oh my God, you believe in it. What are you talking about?
Do you believe in it? No, some people think that I'm being a conspiracy theorist. I mean, they think that I'm just making it up.
It's actually quite well documented throughout history, many instances. In 87, I mean, Art Cashin has gone on many times to recreate and replay that back, where the banks called the Fed and said, by the way, we have all this insurance, it's going to be bad. And then they said, why don't you start buying stocks now? And that was it. And that's going back to 87. So we've had many, many, many instances of the Feds giving the wink nod in order to move stocks. There's many ways to do it now, though, because they can do it through bonds. They can do it through selling vol. So they don't have to go and directly buy equity futures in order to move markets dramatically. And honestly, all they have to do is get somebody else to do it with a wink nod. And that can be, I mean, look at overnight repo, right? Overnight repo is a great way to do it because you're basically telling them, like, hi, we're going to give you a shit ton of liquidity. What are you going to do at 3 a.m.? That's it.
No, all you have to do is, and moreover, and in this day and age, you just have to get the machine who doesn't think at all to believe, and then they just chase the pattern. So, I mean, more, to me, it appears that there's more than a collective effort from the buy side fully loaded, whether it's the quants or other people with an interesting agenda, to make that happen. It's an interesting setup. I mean, to me, it's quite bubbly. I don't think you entirely disagree with that. There's a lot of behavior out there that is beyond bubbly. I mean, what do you think about that component of this into the setup, the whole notion that I think the one-liner is stocks don't go down?
Well, I just wanted to get back to the Fed's job, okay? And the whole thing about being the Fed chairperson, is being the Fed chairperson. And if Trump doesn't win, he's not going to be here for the next term. And that's it. So really, it's job protection and plunge protection, is that he has to work hard to make sure that this elected official that appointed him stays in the White House so he can be the Fed chair. Nobody wants to be a one-termer. So he's really just doing what's in the self-interest of his job. And it was really fun to watch the transition of his realization of what his job really is. And we saw that in, December of 18, when he was pulling out the academic playbook and he's like, well, I'm gonna be hiking rates because this is the right thing to do. And then all of a sudden he started losing control of the long end of the yield curve. And that's when he realized what his real job is. It's to simply make the US appear as if it's solvent, which is the same job as the BOJ and the ECB right now. And that's it, and that's his job. And it was really amazing to watch his eyes open up and say, oh my God, I'm a monkey in the cage and I press the button and that's it. And I'm sorry if he'll see this and he'll be terribly, upset about this. And I believe that maybe somewhere he believes that his job is different. But if you simply look at what they do and not what they say specifically, it becomes extremely clear what all of their jobs are. They have governments that are way over their head in sovereign paper. And so they have to keep printing in order to make it appear as if there's no problem. And the BOJ is a fantastic example of this, where they printed and still printing right through 3% jobless. So we'd always say, oh, well, it's inflation target and jobless. And remember the famous Draghi, who determined that price stability as his mandate meant that prices can't go down. Really, price stability was more around inflation and the cost of goods prices going up. And he was supposed to be maintaining price stability so that people don't get robbed of their buying power. But he reinterpreted it as prices shouldn't go down. And so I'm going to get there and print money. Because the truth is that the bond vigilantes for all of these countries are just sitting there in the wings waiting to dump as soon as the central banks blink. Because they are the buyer. They're just the buyer. And the moment they walk away, think they're going to walk away, whisper, wink that they're going to walk away, everybody's going to walk away at the same time. And that's the conundrum that they're all in. And it was really fun, though, to watch that at that time. Powell have that realization is like, well, I'm going to play it by the book. And then he finds out, oh, my God, there is no book. I'm totally screwed. And it's been amazing to watch. And it's a little bit upsetting that nobody writes about that. And nobody has really articulated this sort of phenomenon. And it's exactly what we have been watching. And look, I have the utmost respect for you. You sat in the same chair that we did during the last meltdown. And there's very few people that did it. And I know you did it well and survived it and can say they survived it. So we thought that Fed chairs had a different job then. And over the past 10 years, we've all got to realize that their jobs are completely different now and are not going to change for the foreseeable future.
And you have a lot of people, thanks for that recap, because that's not the way that people generally recap the Fed, as a matter of factly. But, you know, when we go from here, that's the most important point. I mean, the Fed actually, and there, I guess some people may have forgot this, but, I mean, in the beginning of the Fed's, okay, we're going easy, we're going to do whatever it takes, the market actually got body bagged by that. I'm talking about the stock market. Of course, the bond market and gold have made new highs all along without anywhere near the kind of volatility that equities have had. But now you're at the all-time highs. You know, you're at a very different point for the Fed to make a particular move. And that to me is the most important thing. As you know, like how I build my model, it's fractally. So it's the particular that matters. It's not the average of things or, God forbid, some bloody moving average. What we know is that, talk about monkeys hitting buttons, as soon as the moving averages break, they have to sell. So what is it that breaks the back of momentum again? I have my own answers, but I mean, I'm wondering, given your focus on negative versus positive momentum as a factor exposure, you know, what you think about that?
Well, that brings us up to the trades moving forward. And for the people that follow me on Twitter, am I allowed to say my Twitter handle?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. At Biotequity. It's a handle that I had all the way back from AOL.com. And that was the time when even at big shops like Millennium, all of my orders would literally be on AOL.com just going da-da-da-da-da-da, return. You know, what did you say? Exactly. No, I need to buy 100 million, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, I have to go to the bathroom. You know, and that's really how it was. But that's how that handle stuck with me. So it's Biotequity at Biotequity. And so the trades, it really brings for me to think about these trades that are coming forward. People that had followed me realized that I was short in the recent days, negative momentum. And negative momentum, I got a lot of questions on this. And negative momentum simply means, essentially, in the most simplest form, is where is the stock chart over a one-year period? Is it down, negative momentum, or is it up? And then you could make it relative and say, well, what is it relative to the S&P or some other index? Is it below that in a trend? And that is a momentum factor, negative momentum factor, positive. And it's the same definition in physics, like a vector. And I always look at stocks as a vector. They have mass, they have direction. They are this way, they're this way, they're this way. And the mass really has to do with the dollar weighted volume that's going on there. And that's how I think of momentum. But I've been short negative momentum now that the rubber hit the road and the economy started back up, because now it gets much harder. Much, much harder as of this month and moving forward, in my opinion. And we were long negative momentum, meaning garbage, going into the expiration of the lockup. And that trade worked too. So net-net, it's a good year. I have not taken a lot of directional bias, believe it or not. I've taken factor. I am currently long positive momentum, and I am short negative momentum. There will likely be a moment where that changes, but I don't think that that's going to work until September or sometime around the second week of August to the second week of September.
Well, I mean, that worked, obviously, at one point, you know, quite quickly this year. But again, yes. It works after both things move directionally. It's not that complicated. I mean, I think that people kind of struggle with people that are like, what's your call in the market? And I keep saying, I don't have a call on SPYs. I haven't traded it since 2019. But short, the Russell and short financials are basically, you know, I'm short negative momentum, and long tech is long positive momentum. That's a simple way for people to wrap their heads around what you just said.
Yes.
And when it breaks, and this is my real question for you, which is like, when everybody's in. I mean, we got Barstool in, we got everybody in. You know,
we're very close.
Yesterday, the NASDAQ's hitting an all-time high, and in consumer cyclicals like cruise lines, casinos, shitty restaurants, they're all getting smoked. I mean, it was a great, it's been actually a great week, couple weeks here for generating alpha with the setup that you have. But at a point, you get, like as DeMarc would say, exhausted. Like this relationship gets exhausted. So what do you do and how, I mean, you've made and I've made a series of mistakes around those pivot points, but they're pretty violent and you try not to make them that often.
the way that I say it to my guys, and I talk every day to about regularly, let's say every day to a group of 25 to 35 portfolio managers out there, and many of which I've mentored, some are friends and some are new because they just want to talk, what do you think about this, especially if things are tough. And really the only reason, I mean, I'd like to think they talk to me because I'm a nice guy and they like my company, but maybe it's because I survived the two recessions and made money in both, and that's it. And so they just want a sounding board. Does this make sense? And I'm really receptive to that because anybody who's bright and reaches out to me is like a real thrill for me because I'm going to learn something. I'm going to learn something I didn't know. Right. And that just literally, I think it's a lot like you, where you're learning stuff you didn't know before. And it's just amazing. It's so exciting to learn stuff. And I will say this to the 25 that have called me, and I tweeted it yesterday. I am up 500 basis points today in my book, and I was up 400 bips yesterday in my book. And I'm not patting myself on the back and say, wow, I had a 900 basis point move. It's ludicrous, okay? That's what tops look like, where everybody figures out your strategy, whatever it is, and then everybody piles on, and you tend to have that whipping profit effect right towards the end when, like you said, the factors turn. And right now, we are in factor mayhem, and not for the regular guy, and honestly, not for the directional guy. I believe that, for instance, Dalio, I think, takes massive directional bets, and he runs a relatively unhedged book. So he may not be looking at this too much, but Citadel, Millennium, all the paired books, Bally Asney, Stevie Cohen, they're running, I'll just give Citadel, for example. They run more leverage than most. They're running about a 9x equity levered book. And so their equity book is probably around $140 billion or so. And I'm not including Laquant, but I think it's between 100 and 140, depending on how much they turn the lever on. And the momentum factor right now is off the charts because the winning hand has been massively crazy long momentum and short negative momentum. And so when you add that up in a book where your positive momentum is positive, but you subtract the momentum factor from your short book. But if your short book is negative momentum, it's a double negative. And that means it's a positive if the market moves. So they end up being long momentum in their short book, because it's negative, and then long momentum in their long book. So what it means is that if the market's going to tank, they have very little protection. And so they're not really running hedge books at all. When I was at Citadel, over 10 years ago, we would get an email or a tap on the shoulder. That's always very exciting email. And it's a Mike. I got it. And it would be the risk guys, you know. And they say, hey, Mike, I got to tell you, you know, we're going to flip the risk model in 4 days or 5 days. Yeah. And this is what your risk model is going to look like. Because I only see the risk model that they give me right now. But the back guys in the back office are always, you know, redoing it. Right now, momentum's off the charts. And so they'd send me a picture of what my book, risk-wise, is going to look like the day after. And so if you look in my calendar at 5 days before every single month end, I have a reminder, risk roll. It says risk roll. And I'll think about momentum factor specifically because that's something that hedge funds are terrible at, net-net, and it usually gets them in a lot of trouble. And I'll look at, was this an extreme momentum moment? And is the risk profile going to flip abruptly in the next 5 days? Because everyone's getting tapped on the shoulder now to move it, and they got to start moving their feet. Well, moving their feet means selling their winners and covering their shorts that are negative momentum. And that's exactly what you were talking about in the flip on momentum factor. And most of the time, in my view, it is spurred by that tap on the shoulder that everybody gets on the same day. Hey, our risk is gonna go crazy when we flip this calendar page. So you gotta start taking it down now. And so you frequently see that the last 3 or 4 days of the month, you'll see the risk roll.
Yeah. Well, you can also see, and I've started to make this case just to myself in my own head, and thanks for having this discussion live, because these aren't the discussions that I can have in an open architecture. That's kind of why we built HedgeEye, so that people could listen in on this kind of a conversation. But I think that that's moved quite literally a week. Like, if you look at what happened, the capitulation high of June the 8th, I mean, we're right on the screws, July the 8th, it looks like the same setup to me. Where you thought that the moment would come on the turn of the month, but then you get 3 to 4 to 5 more days of the FU move, and then everybody's really given up. I mean, we've also seen another leading indicator on that is the capitulation of guys showing CFTC futures and options contracts. Just even in S&P index and E-mini, you know, they covered a shit ton of hedge in the last couple weeks of June. So it's a very different setup with similar behavioral characteristics, setup being the net positioning of the market versus the behavioral, like the machine or the meme of chasing the momentum into the first week of the month, of the new month.
What I can tell you is many of the shops, and I don't want to say which ones, actually changed that model too, where they're like, wait a minute, everybody's gaming us on this risk roll. Well, let's do it weekly.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And then it turned to daily.
Daily.
And I know one very large shop where it's hourly.
Ah, yes, I love it. I love it. People think I'm nuts.
The magic risk robot is sticking crap in your book to hedge your factor risk on the hour.
I've started to do this.
Can you imagine that?
I've started to do it every, I do it basically between 9:50 in the morning because I won't transact till the first wave of FOMO is out of, you know, the monkeys are done.
That's me.
Yeah, you wait 20 minutes, particularly in a developing bear market because that's when you get the most violent squeezes. But between 9:50 and 11 o'clock, I'll roll. And then between 2 and 3 or 4 in the afternoon, I'll do it again. So when people get pissed at me, they're like, you bloody day trader, like what? I thought you were Mr. Macro Trending Guy. I'm like, yeah, but I could still trade. And they're literally like games within the game. There are all these OODA loops, as I would call them. And that's exactly what I see going on, is that they've gone from, and again, how my model works, but I called it the immediate term trade duration, which is 3 weeks or less, because the machines used to do it a month, so you're 1 week ahead. Right? It's like, no shit,
that's
Sherlock.
That's what it's turned into.
Right? So trends are 3 months or more. All the super duper smart people that we've worked with, some of them no longer work in the industry because they're too smart. So those are quarterly investors. But those are the trends. And then the trades are quite literally, I was trying to front run, you know, no offense to Magnetar, but basically what I learned there, which is, you know, the 1 month. And then now we've, like you said, that's exactly what's happened. You've had so many people crowding into these very short-term loops that it's almost like it's, I'm asking this as plainly as I can. To me, that's why we're perpetuating the vol signal, because that's too much, too often, to get the bloody thing that won't make the market S&P broadly or Russell, God forbid that thing ever goes up again. But I mean, it can't go up until that volatility goes away, and you can't get the volatility to go away until you stop people doing that.
Well, that's a good point. You know, I mean, one thing that's different, very different over the past 7 years is vol, like you mentioned, and the VIX. The options market is no longer really a market of buyers and sellers, meaning that you've probably noticed some days the VIX will just move 30%. And in rough terms, it means that the cost of puts, or calls, but usually puts, moves 30% in a day, right? And then you're like, who the hell just did that? Because it just moved, gapped in an hour. Who is that? Well, it's not buyers and sellers. It's a market maker. It's a market maker who says, holy crap, I don't want to sell any puts to anybody except for an absolute rip-off price. And it's so what really is a terribly inefficient market, amazingly efficient for them, but terribly inefficient for investors. And so when you see sometimes that the VIX is high, like it is now, you say to yourself, whoa, this is a great opportunity because hedge funds are all grossed up in puts. Hold on, let me check my put-call ratio right now, because it's something that I look at constantly, and I didn't look at it today, and I should be fired. All right, here we go. So where's the VIX right now? Where's the VIX? Oh, is it still 30?
It's like 27, 28.
27, all right, there it is. 27.93, all right. And the put-call ratio is 0.42. 0.42. 0.42. Okay, my friends, what that means is that there are, what it means is out there is that there are more calls being bought, if you will, versus puts. And that's the positioning. So more people have calls than they do puts. In fact, the put call ratio right now is lower than it was in February at the highs.
Exactly.
Yet the VIX is at 27. So what you have is an unbelievably expensive put that nobody owns. So the hedge funds don't actually have protection on. And that's one of the giant miscues that you're seeing in the tape right now, is that you're looking at a high cost of puts and you're making the assumption, well, everyone's hedged up, so you got to go long. And I'm telling you right now, they don't have protection on, period. And you can see that in the put call ratio.
Yeah, the you can see it also, guys. Show the implied vol discount and premium table. This morning I was reviewing this actually on the macro show, which is in financials, and this is why I grossed up my financials position back to max yesterday, which means that I'm not just shorting the cash, but also buying puts more aggressively. 25% discount to what's been realized in the last 30 days. You see these, there's literally 1 to 3 days in a month where it's like short seller, lights are green, go. Like, it's take the bear side. And that, you could see these things move very, very quickly.
You got to be awake, because it happens fast.
Yep.
And shockingly so. Like, you bring your Snapple bottle, don't go to the bathroom, exactly. You're prepped here because it's going to happen. And it's kind of an exciting moment like that, because it's like, as the world turns, we talked about earlier today, it is a soap opera and it never ends. And it's really fun, if you like that sort of.
Well, I love As the World Turns. I mean, I used to be a big fan of the Desecrator in Salem on Days of Our Lives back in my junior hockey playing days. So again, we wouldn't go to school. Look at me. I didn't get the lowest SAT score at Yale by going to school. Are you kidding me? I mean, so you end up in these places where it's like, oh, I've seen this part of the movie, but there's an interesting new twist. And what I try to tell people, and you said this last time, it was one of the best lessons that I think anybody has had on Hedgeye TV, which is basically make money. Don't be right, make money. Now, how about this? Don't focus so bloody much on the narrative. Stop reading the old walls' narratives. Again, it has nothing to do with the narrative. It has everything to do with the math.
You have to read it. You have to read it.
You got to read it. It's like a soap opera, but you don't have to be emotionally affected by it.
No, but you have to read it. You have to know, our good friend Ed Hyman at ISI produces an amazing product. He has never, ever told me to not buy stocks. 20 years.
I love it.
And you know what? He's been right.
Well, 80% of the time that works or something. Maybe
so he's been right. Yeah. And I got to credit him with that. But at a shop like mine, doing what I did and still do now, I wouldn't be able to be sitting in that chair anymore if I simply took that advice. So you just have to take a huge swatch of information and process it for yourself and say, uh-huh. And that's if you want to be a good active manager. And honestly, that number is getting smaller and smaller. About 55% of the allocation is passive money now. And remember that all that passive money that flows into markets has to be bought almost entirely by an active manager, meaning the active manager has to sell to the passive money that's flowing in. And so that's one of the reasons why we're going to see very, very, very increasingly exaggerated markets from here on out.
Well, then people don't understand that at all. I mean, generally speaking, I think obviously pros do, like you and slide four guys, our subscribers obviously get this. I mean, just the evolution of the flow. I mean, this. Can you see these charts, Mike, or no? As we pop
up. No, I'm just staring. Oh, there it is.
Slide
nice.
Four. Slide four.
It did pop up.
There it is. No, but the black bar is basically what you just said, the passive flow, and the blue bar is hedge funds. Okay?
Yes. Yes.
So, and do you think something's going on?
I have to tell you something, and I'm not going to say the name, but a very, very close and dear friend of mine is very successfully running a relatively new hedge fund, and his entire premise of that hedge fund is, I don't want to give away a strategy, but it is basically upon that and based around derivatives. And for that means options for some of your listeners. And that the derivatives are mispriced, not incorporating that transition, which is relentless. And he has done spectacularly. He's a brilliant guy. I would love to pump him on your show, but I don't want to say his name is because I don't want to give away his strategy and so forth. But it's one of those things where, wow, I see that. I'm not sure how I'd actually trade it. Wow, you're a genius for figuring that out. By the way, we've been talking about this for he and I for 10 years. And boom, he's nailed it. He's cooked it. And he's just putting up numbers that I'm up. Well, I'm probably up in the low 30s this year, 34, something like that, and which is a great year. That's great. But the amount of goddamn sweat I had to put in to do that, picking single stocks and all that stuff, my yeah. God, I wish I could just have, hey, this strategy and just do, and it works. Wow, that would be nice.
Well, so people,
I got to sweat it out like you.
But thanks for articulating that, because, I mean, you've taught actually a lot of our subscribers how to use, you know, what I'm actually sending people. Real-time alerts, for example. I mean, if you're trading options, which I absolutely do on all these ETFs, which is basically the flow part of that chart, you know, these 1, 2 to 3% moves in an ETF, like shorting Spain, if you just do it with the cash, that doesn't work so well, relatively speaking, to like 2 week puts or 1 week puts yesterday. I mean, you make a shitload of money doing this. And some people are like, oh, yes, you're doing the 1 to 3% thing. It's like, we need to teach people how to use options in short-term trading strategies, because it highly augments all the blood, sweat, and tears we put into these bloody ideas that we have.
Yes, but frequently those options opportunities, they close out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So you have to be watching. And I'll give you an example. Last week, Pfizer, right in front of their COVID-19 data, the day before it came out, the calls, near the money calls, were trading for 22 cents, 21 cents, 22 cents. And I scooped up a lot of them personally, and it was a 4X payout in one day.
Mm-hmm.
And I called all my guys. You know, we're on Bloomberg Chat, and these are all the critical mass guys that used to work for me, and now they're running money all over in healthcare, all over the world, and I'm so proud of all of them. And there's about 7 or 8 of them on our chat right now, and I was like, "Have you seen this?" And I just, you know, because I get so excited, what the hell is going on? What am I missing? And they're like, "Well, I don't know. Well, I don't know." And I'm like, "Okay, I'm buying thousands right now." And that was it. And so you're absolutely right about trading the options. If you're quick and watching and understand what it is, you can do extremely well. And it's not a 1 to 2% return. We're talking sometimes a 2-3x return. And you just have to be very sensitive about exit and exiting specifically. And of course, the bid ask on the price, because they can scalp you for a fortune there.
Yeah, you just have to be dispassionate. Don't look at your cost basis. If it doesn't work, quite literally for me, within 48 hours, it's gone. You know, you have to be disciplined. And again, that's an important lesson that people should have. But it's also fading the machine. You know, generally speaking, if you're going to make money, you know, buying puts or if you're buying calls, just to use really basic stuff, do it from the top and the bottom end of the risk range. That's when you're going to get the best price and you're going to get the best pop. So I'm going to keep trying to teach people that. We're running out of some time here before I get to some questions, but and we will do questions next. If you have questions for Mike, pop them in the queue. Quite a few of them are there already. But first, I want to give you my first question is like, what's your best ideas here?
Okay.
Or best idea? If you want to go with one, or like maybe we won't even have a Q&A if you just keep talking. I'm sure everybody wants
to know. Last time I recommended for your viewers Long Humana.
That was an awesome call.
A US HMO. They're still going to crush numbers. And I believe that this COVID problem is going to be sticking with us for the rest of the year into next year. And so they're going to crush it because nobody's going to be utilizing healthcare, yet all the Medicare patients will continue to pay. So that's still a law. I did come across, as you know, I look a lot at COVID virus and everybody that's working on it. I came across a Swiss company, and I don't normally trade a lot of international stocks, but there is a Swiss company called Molecular Partners, and they have a cocktail of antibodies to treat COVID virus, and it's going into the clinic right now. It's very similar to Regeneron's approach, and I've been positive on Regeneron's approach. We're going to see more data in the coming weeks on if it's treatable. But what's different is theirs from Regeneron's is that theirs is the only one that is subcutaneously dosed. Regeneron's is IV, and it's predominantly going to be dosed in the hospital when you're inpatient admitted. But you're going to lose 90% of the market, which are the people that don't get admitted. And Molecular Partners can pick that up, all of it. And that is a ridiculous market. So this Swiss company is a $300 million market cap. They're going through a raise right now, which I believe was a reverse inquiry where investors came to them and said, take my money, please, because they believe in this antibody approach. We'll have data from them in September. Late September, I think it's going to be late September. It might be early October, but I think late September. And I don't understand how it's not a 5X if that data looks good. And just on that, it's, many of the comps right now without data are trading at $3 to $5 billion market cap. And that's over 10X higher than where that stock is now. So I own six digits of it personally. Multiple six digits. The only reason I'm not seven is because it's difficult to trade. Oh, and actually, I kind of blew it right now because I should have bought more before this program. I forgot that.
You want to do that again? That was impact. That was not.
So I think they're going to crush this data. I'm familiar with the technology, and they're using a similar approach to Regeneron, but they're going to pick up all the market, 90% of the market that Regeneron misses. And I mean, think about it. If you have 1 million people infected that present at the PCP, meaning the primary care physician, and this is something that they could dose subcutaneously right there, you test COVID positive, here's your antibody cocktail, boom, thank you very much, $5,000 times 1 million people in the US alone. And well, that's $5 billion, and it's probably gonna be a lot more than 1 million people. So that's an incredibly huge market. And they're the only one I know of that has that. I believe in the distant future, there may be approaches like that, but they're first. And that'll be it. So that's my pick of the day.
I like that. Picks. Yeah, people like their picks. All right, let's get some questions. Thank you for that, Mike. Appreciate that. First one is from Drew. Mike, last time you were on HedgeEye, you said you're net long for the first time in a long time. Is it time to be net short this time? And what's your favorite sector to be short of?
Thank you. My favorite sectors to be short going into this COVID ramp is going to be consumer, leisure, travel, banks. And a funny thing that if you've noticed in the leisure travel / casinos, Macau hasn't opened up yet. And at my last check of my official Chinese news is that there's no problem with COVID virus in China. And but strangely, they've kept Macau closed. So the casinos, I think, are in for a hell of a time for the back half of the year. A negative time, if you will.
Yeah. Here's another, this is a bit of a FOMO question, this is a FOMO question. Do you think that the market will ignore any earnings declines going forward because the Fed has announced that they'll buy everything for years?
Well, that won't have anything to do with earnings declines, right? I guess is he talking stock declines,
yeah,
not earnings declines?
Well, you know, will stocks, if earnings go down a lot, will stocks never go down a lot because the Fed said so?
You know, that's a great point. And about 4 months ago, I'd probably say no. And that was before another like 7 million retail accounts have opened up. And I think all of them are smaller accounts. They're all on call. They have calls in Tesla. And that's the trade. And when you get a sea of retail people in thinking they cannot lose money, and it doesn't matter what the reason is. It's the Fed, it's the fairy godmother, it's a great economy, it doesn't matter what it is. When you get a lot of individual investors plowing into the market all along with new money, and you know, and they did a good job buying the bounce, by the way, net-net, that sets you up for a problem. And when you look at the put-call ratio, and it's 0.42 today, that is like alarm bell in my head, sell, sell, sell. So I'm gonna stay long my favorite healthcare names, because I, as many of you know, I'm a healthcare specialist. I did drug development for a number of years and then traded healthcare stocks for the past 20. I'm going to stick long with them, but I'm going to be short what I just mentioned. And I am short what I just mentioned.
It's amazing, so, too. And buying the puts on what you just mentioned is really cheap going into earnings. And we've also and obviously seen any company that pre-announced or anybody who's off quarter in terms of their reports, if they miss, and it could have even been like some software companies like Medallia, Smartsheet, Work or Slack, you know, these names just like down double digits in a day. So again, I love going into that setup. You know, Dan Benton used to be at Pequot. I don't know if you know him or not. He used to say there's macro season, then there's earnings season. When you have both at an intersection that have similar sets, you know, it's really, I think it's going to be an awesome earnings season for people that are in and out of the right stocks.
We also have a very unique macro situation, because the forbearance of payments on everything usually lasts about 3 months, March, April, May, some of June. Now July comes. That's all expired. And so people are now going to have to start making payments after they didn't. And frequently the previous payments will be slapped on top of the payments they're making now. And so they're going to owe a lot of money that they didn't as a comp. In addition, jobless unemployment benefits start to roll. And then lastly, the PPP starts to roll for companies. And what I mean is that employers couldn't dismiss some of their workforce until they held them for 8 weeks. And it was 8 weeks post receiving the check from the government. And that 8 weeks is hitting right now. So in the small businesses that I talk to, every single one of them expect to lay off workers over the next 2 months. So when I put all of those things together with a heavily retail invested fresh helicopter money into the stock market at highs, and the put call ratio 0.42, I am net very, very bearish when I see that.
Yeah, me too. One thing, just to put a picture on what Mike just said, like we call it the policy support cliff, slide 50, guys, just so you can see. We put dates on all the things that are effectively expiring. The people's answer to that, of course, Mike, would be they're just going to do it again and again and again. I don't want to. We only have.
Oh, I agree. But that's probably September, and everybody knows that September is 3 careers from now.
Totally. I love that. How I was talking about that this morning in the early look. You know, everyone loves the rate of change acceleration off the, you know, these proctologists that have all called the bottom. You know, they love that. But they don't want to talk about the next 3 data points, the July, August, September data points. They just want to draw a secant line out to 2021 earnings. So that's fine. That's kind of typically how they'd model it. This question I want to ask, this one's got a lot of votes. And this is your view on the man-made nature of COVID-19. Can you expand upon that again, and if your thoughts have broadened?
I did a lot of virus work before. That was most of my drug development work, using virus for gene therapies. And so I'm familiar with virus and how to make viruses that are different than what occurs in nature. And I said this before, I'll say it again, and this is just circumstantial, but it's important. The probability of a animal virus making to the leap to humans and being highly transmissible among humans is unbelievably low, like one in billions that that would happen or could happen. And I mean many, many, many billions. So it is so improbable as to border on impossible. And we do have viruses jumping from animal to human all the time. It's just that they're not very transmissible. And like the other SARS events that we had in the past, they never evolved into something bad because that truly was an animal to human virus, and it wasn't very transmissible in humans. And that's why it fizzled out. But for this to be highly transmissible, coming from or orientating from Wuhan with the only BSL level 4 lab there that would actually be used to make and contain and propagate this sort of virus, with a whole team of people that work specifically on this coronavirus, and we can't see their lab notebooks, what they were doing, meeting notes, any of it, lockdown. The answer is ridiculously clear. It's very painful. And we could go into the specific mutations here and there, and were these man-made, and we could debate that to all end. But that evidence of where it came from, the location, what they were working on, the timelines, it wasn't like, oh, they were working on this 14 years ago and everybody's retired. No, they were working on it last week, you know? They are publishing on this crap. And I think it simply escaped accidentally. And this was the only one that we saw, because this might have been the only one that was human transmissible. There might have been many, many, many viruses that escaped there through bad disposal techniques. It's just we never saw them because they never peaked up in humans.
Do you think that getting to the quote-unquote bottom of that story even matters?
It doesn't matter, right? We're not going to solve any of the problems of humanity getting to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
But what we can do is identify dangerous bad actors that function without law and above consequence. And that's what I think where we could benefit from. But there are so many players that have interests in China, business and PAC dollars that get donated to politicians, that they all want a piece of it, and they're all getting greased. And I don't want to say that's the problem. It's not that it's a problem. It's just a reality. Mm-hmm. And so we'll probably never know. We'll never know the sequence of events. And the hope is of this White House even, is that simply the news cycle will change. And all of a sudden, you won't believe it, but Pee Wee Herman is going to be huge again. And it'll be all over the news, all right? And that's what we'll be talking about next time.
Well, it's kind of amazing to watch it. I don't think it's ironic. Do you? Like, what's happened in terms of Chinese news flow in the last 3 weeks? I mean, talk about turns of events that have now ended up in the renewal of a Chinese stock market bubble. We went from the Himalayas over here to...
Well, they said buy stocks, you see.
Yeah.
Right? So, and the way they do it is really amazing. Like, you were talking about the plunge protection team. They literally just call up the brokerage houses and say, we give you more credit now.
Yeah.
Thank you. Bye. And that's it. And stocks go straight up. And a lot of people will look at it and say, well, why aren't we like that? Why don't we do that? Well, you know, and I know why, is because that points to an unbelievable misallocation of capital. And what that turns into eventually is a gigantic debt bomb inflation bubble that blows up all over their faces. And throughout history, every single command economy has ended their history with that. All of them.
Well, I have to, that has to be my last question to you. I mean, is this the mother of all bubbles in terms of not just, I mean, U.S. equities, wrap it up with Chinese momentum stocks? That's a big part of the momentum factor, too.
No, I actually don't think this is the biggest bubble, because I think it's going to get bigger. And I believe that we are going to have a ludicrously sized stimulus package and another one not as large in the spring of next year. And I believe that while we will have, I believe, a pretty hard pullback in the near term weeks, 6 to 7 weeks or so. But secretly, I really think it's like literally within the next week or so it'll start. But but give me more time so that I can be right.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, give me more time so I can make money. Forget about being right. And I think that we're going to have an incredible helicopter money event. That's what I think is going to happen. We're going to have a huge helicopter money event, and then we're going to have the trifecta of insanity, where the velocity of money turns around as this does incrementally improve next year. It won't be a solve all, but it will increment. The comps will be easier, just like that. We're going to have a lot of stimulus money floating around, and we're going to have the Fed. And the Fed's going to become like the BOJ, where they now have so much paper out there in debt that they can't let the long end lift. And so they're going to print money all the way into full employment, like during full employment. We'll be very much like Japan, in my view. And that is a trifecta, crazy train move, place for stocks. And then I believe we'll have the biggest bubble ever. So back half 21. And that's when inflation will start to come in. And I don't know if it says that in your models, but I see back half of next year, very likely we see bad inflation with deglobalization, a persistent move down in the dollar throughout the second half of next year. And I think that wherever the dollar is, I think around September is going to be the most recent high for the dollar. And it will be an incredible opportunity to be long emerging markets, short U.S. dollar, which is kind of the same trade. And so I think there's tremendous trade, but we'll cover that then. And we'll talk about what the great trades are then. But I do have a lot of things that are coming together in my mind and how to make a mint on this. And hopefully we can do it together.
Love that, man. And, you know, ordinarily they say the man, the myth, the legend. It's you're not a myth. You're actually the guy right there. And the calls you're starting to make are there's a little legend to this starting to develop, Mike. So we definitely have to invite you back and have these conversations.
Hey, I'm just a troglodyte with a keyboard.
And that's the rest of the story. Thank you. I appreciate it. He's Mike Taylor. You can find his tweets. I mean, his tweet action is pretty legendary, too. But again, a genuine honor to have that conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. As a reminder, new Hedgeye subscribers may qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com. Hedgeye Risk Management is a registered investment advisor registered with the state of Connecticut. Hedgeye Risk Management is not a broker-dealer and does not provide investment advice for individuals. This research does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security. This research is presented without regard to individual investment preferences or risk parameters. It is general information and does not constitute specific investment advice. Nothing presented herein should be construed as legal or tax advice. This presentation is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye Risk Management is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of Hedgeye, and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye Risk Management's clients and subscribers. In reaching these opinions and conclusions, the individuals expressing those opinions and conclusions and their employees have relied upon research which is based upon sources considered credible and reliable within the industry. Neither Hedgeye Risk Management nor any individual expressing those opinions and conclusions are responsible for the validity or authenticity of the information upon which it has relied.